A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's standing in a stationery shop, looking at his own Sakura Pigma Micron 05, and wondering what actually goes into making a marker archival grade. What does that AP seal mean? What chemistry is sitting inside that pen barrel? And what kind of durability does any of this actually guarantee?
The answer to that first question, what the AP seal means, is going to surprise a lot of people, because it has nothing to do with how long your drawing lasts.
Of course it doesn't.
The AP seal stands for Approved Product. It's from the Art and Creative Materials Institute, the ACMI. And it certifies exactly one thing, toxicology. The product has been evaluated by a board-certified toxicologist and contains no materials in quantities sufficient to cause chronic health problems. That's it. No light fastness testing, no pH measurement, no accelerated aging. It's a safety sticker, not a longevity guarantee.
A crayon that melts off the page in 6 months could wear that seal, and a marker that fades in direct sunlight in 3 weeks could wear that seal, as long as neither one gives your toddler heavy metal poisoning.
And that's the first big misconception we need to clear up. The AP seal is pervasively misunderstood as some kind of quality or durability mark. It's not. It's the art supply equivalent of a food-grade label. Important, but answering a completely different question than the one most consumers think they're asking.
Let's start with what those two little letters actually mean, because it's probably not what you think. And then let's get into what archival actually is. The chemistry, the standards, the testing, and the gap between what the lab promises and what your sketchbook actually delivers.
Let's define the vocabulary first, because archival grade in the context of writing instruments isn't a single standard. It's a cluster of properties that have to work together. Light fastness, resistance to fading under light exposure. Chemical stability, the ink doesn't react with itself or with the paper over decades. Water resistance, it doesn't dissolve or migrate when humidity hits. And pH neutrality, the ink isn't acidic enough to eat the paper from the inside.
The core tension here is that permanent and archival are constantly conflated, but they measure fundamentally different things. Permanence is about resistance to removal. Can I scrub this off? Does water lift it? Does acetone dissolve it? Archival is about resistance to degradation over time. A thing can be extremely permanent for 3 years and then crumble. A thing can be archival for a century, but lift right off if you spill solvent on it.
The Sharpie versus the Pigma Micron is the canonical example here. A Sharpie ultra-fine point uses a dye-based ink with a pH around 4.5 to 5.0. That's acidic. It's permanent in the sense that it bonds aggressively to surfaces and resists water and many solvents. But leave a Sharpie drawing in indirect sunlight for 2 to 3 years and it will visibly fade. The dye molecules break down. The paper around the ink line starts yellowing from acid hydrolysis. It's permanent today, degraded tomorrow.
The Pigma Micron?
Pigment-based pH buffered to around 7.0 to 7.5 using nanopigment particles suspended in a water-based acrylic resin binder. It's not trying to be solvent-proof. It's trying to be chemically inert for over a century. Different engineering goal entirely.
With that vocabulary in place, let's open up a Sakura Pigma Micron and look at what's actually inside, because the chemistry is where the real story lives.
There are two main certification frameworks that actually address archival quality. The first is ASTM D6901-15, which is specifically the standard specification for artist colored pencils and markers, pigment-based archival quality. The second is ISO 11798, which covers permanence and durability of writing and printing on paper. But ASTM D6901 is the one most referenced on marker packaging, so let's focus there.
What does it actually require?
First, the ink must be pigment-based, not dye-based. That's non-negotiable. Dye molecules dissolve at the molecular level, their individual molecules floating in a solvent. Pigment particles are insoluble solids, physically distinct from the carrier. Second, minimum 2% pigment load by weight. That sounds low, but in ink formulation, 2% is actually substantial. It's enough to leave a dense, opaque mark. Third, pH must fall between 6.5 and 8.0, neutral to slightly alkaline. And fourth, light fastness testing using the blue wool scale with a minimum rating of 4 out of 8 for a 100-year projection.
Explain the blue wool scale. I've seen it referenced, but never broken down.
It's a standardized fading test developed originally for the textile industry. You take 8 wool samples, each dyed with a different blue dye of known fading sensitivity. Blue wool 1 fades extremely fast. It's basically the canary in the coal mine. Blue wool 8 is extraordinarily stable. You expose your test sample and the wool swatches to the same light source simultaneously, and you track how long it takes for your sample to show the same amount of fading as each wool reference. A rating of 4 means your ink fades at roughly the same rate as blue wool 4 under controlled xenon arc exposure.
That maps to a century?
Under specific assumptions. The ASTM test accelerates aging using 24-hour cycles of high-intensity xenon arc light, calibrated to simulate roughly 100 years of museum lighting at 50 lux for 8 hours per day. 50 lux is dim. It's the lighting level the Library of Congress uses for paper artifacts. It's not your sunlit studio window. So when Sakura says 100-year projection, they mean 100 years at museum light levels in a climate-controlled environment. Which brings us to the gap between lab and real world, but we'll get there.
Let's talk about what's actually in the Pigma Micron. You mentioned nanopigment dispersion.
This is where Sakura's formulation gets genuinely interesting. They use a proprietary process to grind pigment particles down to submicron size, typically 0.2 to 0.5 micrometers. For reference, a human hair is about 70 micrometers across. These particles are so small, they can flow through the narrow nib channels without clogging, but they're still solid particles, not dissolved molecules.
The pigment types.
The black Pigma Micron, the O5 that Daniel uses carbon black, but not the traditional lamp black that you'd find in historical India ink. This is a highly engineered furnace carbon black with controlled particle size distribution. The colored versions use synthetic organic pigments. Phthalocyanine blue, quinacridone magenta, things that are chemically designed for stability. These aren't natural mineral pigments ground up. They're synthesized at the molecular level specifically to resist photodegradation.
Phthalocyanine is a word I want on a t-shirt.
It's a gorgeous molecule. It's a large ring structure with a metal ion in the center, usually copper, and it's extraordinarily stable. Phthalocyanine blue has been used in artist paint since the 1930s, and samples from that era show essentially no fading. It's the cockroach of pigments. It'll outlast all of us.
The pigment particles are these submicron solids. What holds them in place?
This is the second critical component, and it doesn't get nearly enough attention. Sakura uses a water-based acrylic resin binder. When you draw a line, the water evaporates and the acrylic resin forms a film that physically locks the pigment particles into the paper fibers. Think of it like this. If pigments are gravel, the binder is the cement. Without the binder, you just have colored dust that brushes off.
Why does pigment versus dye matter at the molecular level for this binding process?
Because dye molecules dissolve. They're individual molecules in solution, and when the solvent, water or alcohol, evaporates, the dye molecules are left sitting loosely on and between paper fibers. They haven't formed a mechanical bond. Over time, they can migrate. That's what causes feathering and bleeding. The dye molecules literally move through the paper structure carried by any moisture present. Pigment particles can't do that. They're too large. Once the binder locks them in place, they stay.
Like adopting a feral cat.
I'm not sure that's the analogy I'd reach for, but yes. Once the binder cures, those pigment particles are not going anywhere without physical abrasion or chemical breakdown of the binder itself.
Let's talk about pH, because you mentioned acidity earlier, and that's where a lot of the long-term damage happens.
This is the mechanism most people never think about. Paper is cellulose, long polymer chains of glucose molecules. Cellulose is chemically stable under neutral or slightly alkaline conditions. But introduce acid. Anything below pH 6, and you get acid-catalyzed hydrolysis. The acid breaks the bonds between glucose units, snipping those long polymer chains into shorter fragments. The paper becomes brittle, yellow, and eventually crumbles.
The ink itself can be the acid source.
If you use an acidic ink on otherwise archival paper, the ink line becomes a weak point. The paper will literally degrade faster along the lines you've drawn. Over 50 years, a drawing on good paper with acidic ink can develop what conservators call burn through, where the ink line physically weakens the paper enough that it tears along the drawing itself.
That's grim.
And this is why archival inks are buffered. Sakura includes calcium carbonate or magnesium carbonate in their formulation, the same compounds used in archival paper manufacturing. These act as alkaline reserves. If any acid forms over time, from atmospheric pollutants, from the paper itself, from any residual chemistry, the carbonate neutralizes it. It's a sacrificial buffer. The ink maintains pH 7 to 7.5 for decades.
The ink is actively protecting the paper while it sits there.
And that's the difference between an engineered archival system and something that's just pigment in water. The buffering is invisible. It doesn't affect the drawing experience, but it's the difference between a document that's readable in 80 years and one that disintegrates when you try to turn the page.
You mentioned a study earlier, the Image Permanence Institute.
This was a 2023 study from the Image Permanence Institute at the Rochester Institute of Technology. They tested 27 markers that were marketed as archival. Only 14 met the ASTM D6901 standard. The other 13 used the word archival on the packaging without meeting any verifiable standard. Some were dye-based. Some had acidic formulations. Some simply hadn't been tested at all, and the manufacturer was relying on the fact that most consumers don't know what questions to ask.
Nearly half the archival markers on the market aren't.
That's the study that really shook things up in the artist community. It's why Copic, which had always been the professional illustrator's marker of choice, faced a reckoning in 2024.
Tell me about the Copic controversy.
Copic sketch markers are alcohol-based, dye-based markers. They're beloved by illustrators and manga artists because they blend beautifully and the color range is enormous, 358 colors. But they are absolutely not archival. The dyes fade. The alcohol carrier is acidic. Copic never claimed they were archival, but they were marketed as professional grade, and many artists assumed professional grade meant archival. When the IPI study came out and artists started comparing notes, there was a lot of frustration. People had sold original artwork for hundreds or thousands of dollars, created with Copic markers, with no disclosure that the colors would shift and fade within a decade or two.
Copic's response?
They released Copic Classic in 2025, a pigment-based archival line with a 50-year projection, narrower color range, slower drying time, but actually engineered for longevity. It was a direct acknowledgement that the market had evolved, and artists now expect professional to mean durable.
50 years versus Sakura's 100. What accounts for the gap?
Pigment load percentage and binder quality primarily. Sakura has been iterating on the Pigma formula since 1982. They have 4 decades of proprietary data on how their specific nanodispersion behaves over time. Copic is new to pigment formulation. Their 50-year projection is conservative because they simply don't have the longitudinal data yet. It might actually last longer, but they can't claim it until they've tested it.
We know what makes a marker archival in the lab, but what happens when that marker leaves the factory and lands in a humid studio, or on glossy photo paper, or under a window with direct sunlight?
This is where the gap between testing conditions and real-world use becomes critical. The ASTM Accelerated Aging Test is rigorous but narrow. It uses xenon arc light, which approximates the spectral distribution of natural daylight, but it's continuous exposure in a controlled chamber. It does not test for UV exposure through window glass, which filters some wavelengths, but not all. It does not test for humidity cycling, your sketchbook going through wet summers and dry winters. It does not test for atmospheric pollutants, sulfur dioxide, ozone, nitrogen oxides, all of which can react with both paper and ink over decades. And it does not test for biological attack, mold, which loves the organic binders in ink and paper.
100-year projection in a museum vault could be 30 years in a Florida garage.
And there are 3 specific failure modes that archival markers face in the real world that the lab testing doesn't fully capture. First, substrate incompatibility. Archival ink is engineered to bond with absorbent, uncoated paper fibers. Use it on glossy photo paper or plastic, and the binder can't mechanically key into the surface. The ink sits on top and can be lifted off with friction or moisture. It's archival ink on a non-archival substrate, which defeats the whole system. The acrylic resin that locks pigment in place continues to cross-link over decades. Cross-linking is what makes the binder strong initially, but too much of it makes the film brittle. After 30 or 40 years, the binder can microcrack, especially if the paper expands and contracts with humidity changes. Those microcracks allow oxygen and moisture to reach the pigment particles, accelerating degradation. It's a slow process, but it's real, and it's why even archival drawings on archival paper should be stored flat in stable conditions.
The third failure mode?
Pigment migration in high humidity. Above about 80% relative humidity, water vapor can infiltrate the paper structure and act as a carrier for pigment particles. Even though the particles are locked in binder, if the binder has microcracked or if the humidity is sustained for weeks or months, you can get a subtle halo effect around ink lines, pigment particles slowly diffusing outward. It's the archival equivalent of feathering, just happening over years instead of seconds.
The marker is only one component. You mentioned the archival system concept earlier.
This is the concept that the Library of Congress and most professional conservators use. An archival system has three components: the ink, the paper, and any adhesives or storage materials. All three have to meet preservation standards, or the system fails at its weakest point. You can use a Pigma Micron on acidic newsprint, and in 20 years the paper will be yellow and brittle regardless of how stable the ink is. You can use it on archival paper, but store the drawing in a PVC sleeve, and the plasticizers leaching out of the PVC will damage both paper and ink.
What should the paper and storage materials be?
For documents intended to last 50-plus years, you want acid-free, buffered paper with a pH of 7.5 to 8.5. The buffering agent is usually calcium carbonate, the same stuff in the ink. For storage, polyester or polypropylene sleeves, never PVC, never vinyl. And if you're framing, use UV filtering glass or acrylic and acid-free mat board. The mat board is often the overlooked component. Cheap mat board is highly acidic and will burn a brown rectangle into your artwork over a decade or two.
You could do everything right with the marker and still have your word destroyed by the folder you put it in.
That's the part that most marketing conveniently omits. No marker manufacturer is going to print test your marker on cheap mat board and tell you the result. They're selling a component, not a system.
Let's talk about the trade-offs. Archival markers aren't just more expensive. They behave differently.
The drying time is the most noticeable. Archival pigment inks on coated paper can take 30 to 60 seconds to dry versus 5 to 10 seconds for a dye-based marker. On uncoated paper, it's faster, maybe 10 to 15 seconds, but if you're used to the instant dry behavior of an alcohol marker, it's an adjustment, and if you don't wait, you'll smudge.
The clogging issue?
Pigment particles, even nano-sized ones, can settle and clog the nib channels if the cap is left off. Sakura recommends you don't leave a Pigma Micron uncapped for more than 15 minutes. A dye-based marker is more forgiving because there are no solid particles to settle. The trade-off is literally solid durability versus liquid convenience.
The color gamut limitation. You mentioned this earlier.
You cannot get fluorescent or neon archival colors. The pigments that produce those colors, the rhodamines, the fluorescines, are inherently photochemically unstable. They're designed to absorb UV and re-emit visible light, which means they're actively interacting with high-energy photons. They degrade quickly. The archival pigment palette is inherently more muted. Earth tones, phthalocyanine blues and greens, quinacridone reds and magentas, carbon blacks. You'll never see a neon pink archival marker because the molecule that makes neon pink can't survive the light fastness testing.
Fluorescent colors are the mayflies of the pigment world.
Beautiful and brief.
You mentioned a 2025 update to the ASTM standard.
They added a wet abrasion test. This simulates a spilled coffee being wiped across a document, a damp cloth passing over the ink line with moderate pressure. This was driven by the rise of alcohol-based markers in industrial settings where chemical resistance matters more than light fastness. If you're labeling a part that's going to be handled with gloved hands and possibly exposed to solvents, you care whether the mark survives a wipe, not whether it lasts a century.
For the archival marker world, wet abrasion is a meaningful real-world test. Someone spills something on your journal. Someone wipes a damp hand across a sketchbook page.
and archival pigment inks generally perform well here because the binder film is water-resistant once cured. A Pigma Micron line, once fully dry, will survive a wet wipe with minimal degradation. A dye-based marker will streak immediately because the dye molecules redissolve in the water.
Let's do a quick comparison table. The three markers someone's most likely to encounter if they're shopping for archival fineliners.
The big three in the archival fineliner space are Sakura Pigma Micron, Unipin Fineline, and Staedtler Pigment Liner. All three are pigment-based. All three claim archival properties, but the specifics differ. The Pigma Micron has a 100-year projection under ASTM testing, typically retails around $350 per pen, and uses Sakura's proprietary nanodispersion with the highest pigment load of the three. The Unipin has a 50-year projection, about $280 per pen, also pigment-based, but with a slightly lower pigment load and a different binder chemistry. Uni uses an oil-based pigment dispersion rather than water-based acrylic. The Staedtler pigment liner has a 30-year projection, around $250 per pen, and uses a pigment ink that's been formulated more for consistent line width than maximum longevity.
You're paying for decades.
You're paying for pigment load and binder quality, which translate directly to projected lifespan. And the price differences are small in absolute terms. We're talking about a dollar difference between a 30-year pen and a 100-year pen. The real cost isn't the pen, it's the artwork you're creating with it.
That's the line that should be on the packaging.
It really should.
All of this raises a practical question. If you're standing in a stationery store right now, how do you actually tell which markers will last and which are just wearing the word archival as a costume?
The actionable checklist is actually fairly short. First, look for both the ACMIAP seal and a specific archival standard reference on the packaging. The standard you want to see is ASTM D6901 or ISO 11798. If the packaging says archival but doesn't cite a standard, you're looking at marketing language, not engineering claims.
AP plus a standard reference.
Verify that the ink is explicitly labeled as pigment-based, not dye-based. If it doesn't say pigment, assume dye. Dye-based markers can be permanent and waterproof and still not be archival. The word permanent on a dye marker is about adhesion, not longevity. Check for a pH claim. Some manufacturers, Sakura does this, explicitly state pH neutral or acid-free on the packaging or the technical data sheet. If they don't, it doesn't mean the ink is acidic, but it means they haven't tested or aren't disclosing. And for something you want to last decades, that's a gap.
If none of this is on the packaging,
pull up the manufacturer's website on your phone. Look for the technical data sheet or the safety data sheet. The SDS won't tell you about archival properties, but the TDS often will. If the manufacturer doesn't publish a technical data sheet with light fastness ratings, pH information, and pigment type, they're not selling to the archival market. They're selling to people who like the word archival.
What about testing your own markers? Say you already own a bunch, and you want to know which ones are actually going to last.
There's a simple test you can do at home. Take each marker, write a sample on the paper you actually use, let it dry completely. Give it a full hour to be safe. Then run the paper under cold tap water for 30 seconds and rub the ink line gently with your finger. An archival pigment ink will be essentially unchanged. A dye-based ink will feather, fade, or lift. It's not a perfect test. It only measures water resistance, not light fastness. But water resistance is a good proxy because most dye-based inks are water-soluble to some degree.
A light fastness test?
Tape a sample to a window that gets direct sun. Leave it for a month. Compare it to a control sample you kept in a dark drawer. If you see visible fading in 30 days of direct sun, that marker is not going to last a century in any conditions. Accelerated light fastness testing for the impatient.
For mixed media artists, people who combine markers with watercolor or acrylic, you mentioned layering order matters.
This is a specific failure mode that catches a lot of artists. If you're combining media, put the archival marker down first, let it dry completely, then apply watercolor or acrylic over it. The pigment binder in the marker can be disrupted by the solvents in overlaying layers. Water is a solvent for water-based acrylic binders, even after curing. If you apply marker over watercolor, the marker tip can pick up pigment from the watercolor and contaminate the nib, and the marker line may not bond properly to the paint surface.
Marker first, wet media second. And always test.
Always test on a scrap of the exact paper you're using. Not similar paper. The exact paper. The interaction between a specific ink formulation and a specific paper coating is complex enough that you can't predict it from general principles. A Pigma Micron that works perfectly on Strathmore Bristol might smear on Canson mixed media paper. The only way to know is to draw a line and try to smudge it.
You've got your archival marker, your acid-free paper, your storage sleeves, but is that enough? There's a bigger question brewing about what archival even means in a changing climate.
This came up at the 2025 ASTM committee meeting. The current accelerated aging tests assume stable temperature and humidity, typically 21 degrees Celsius and 50% relative humidity. But climate change is pushing average humidity up in many regions and increasing the frequency of extreme weather events. A document stored in a house without climate control in Houston or Mumbai is experiencing conditions that the ASTM test does not simulate.
The proposed fix?
The committee discussed adding a tropical climate test cycle that would cycle between high humidity and moderate humidity, simulating conditions in non-climate controlled storage in equatorial and subtropical regions. No decision was made in 2025. The debate is partly technical. How do you design an accelerated test that accurately represents 50 years of variable humidity without introducing artifacts from the cycling itself? And partly economic. Adding a new test cycle increases certification costs, and manufacturers pushed back.
The standard is optimized for the climate conditions of the global north, in climate-controlled buildings.
As most industrial standards historically have been. It's a real limitation, and it's one that conservators in tropical countries have been pointing out for years.
There's another dimension here that I think is worth pulling on. As more and more documents get scanned at 600 dpi or higher and stored digitally, what is physical archival actually for? If you can read the scan forever, why does the original need to last a century?
This is a deep question, and it's shifting how conservators think about their work. The answer that's emerging is provenance. The original physical mark isn't just information, it's evidence. A scanned document tells you what was written. The original document, with its specific ink chemistry and paper fibers, tells you when it was written, with what tools, and potentially by whom. Forensic analysis of the physical artifact can verify authenticity in ways a digital file never can.
The requirement shifts from readable in 100 years to chemically verifiable as original in 100 years.
Which is a much harder problem. Readability just requires contrast between ink and paper. Chemical verifiability requires that the ink hasn't degraded into something else, that the paper hasn't acidified, that the binder hasn't cross-linked into an unrecognizable polymer. The standard for archival permanence might actually need to get stricter as digital preservation handles the readability side.
The future of archival isn't about your grandchildren reading your journal. It's about a forensic chemist proving your journal is your journal.
That's the kind of shift that makes standards committees nervous, because it's not just a new test, it's a new definition of what success means.
Let's pull this into something concrete for someone listening. They've got a marker in their hand right now. What should they do?
First, look at the packaging. AP seal plus a specific standard reference, ASTM D6901 or ISO 11798. If you see both, you're holding a marker that has been engineered and tested for longevity. If you see only AP, you're holding a non-toxic marker of unknown durability. If you see neither, you're holding something that made no verifiable claims at all.
Second, check your paper. Acid-free, buffered, pH 7.5 or higher. It'll say so on the pad or the ream. If it doesn't say acid-free, it's not.
Third, check your storage. Polyester or polypropylene sleeves. If the sleeve has that new shower curtain smell, it's PVC and it's off-gassing plasticizers that will damage your work.
Fourth, if you're serious about a particular marker and paper combination, do the window test. Tape a sample to a sunny window for a month. Compare it to a control kept in a dark drawer. If you see fading, that marker is not archival, regardless of what the packaging says.
Fifth, if you have a favorite marker that claims archival but doesn't cite a standard, email the manufacturer and ask for their test data. If enough consumers ask, manufacturers will start publishing data. The reason so many get away with vague claims is that so few people ask follow-up questions.
The ink industry runs on the fact that most people never check.
The ones that do check get a very different picture of what they're buying. The 14 markers that passed the IPI study are all from manufacturers who published their test data. The 13 that failed are all from manufacturers who don't.
That's not a coincidence.
There really isn't.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1720s, a Jesuit missionary in Greenland recorded the chemical composition of cosmic ray particles by analyzing nitrate deposits in glacial ice cores. He dissolved the ice, precipitated the nitrates with potash, and noted that the resulting crystals fluoresced faintly blue under candlelight, a property he attributed to celestial influence, but which modern analysis identifies as trace perchlorate activated by cosmic ray spallation.
I mean, he wasn't entirely wrong.
He was directionally correct. I'll give him directionally correct.
Here's the open question we're left with. Archival standards today assume a world of stable humidity, filtered light, and climate-controlled rooms. But the world is getting warmer, wetter in many places, and more volatile. The ASTM committee is debating a tropical climate test cycle. If they add it, a lot of products currently labeled archival might not pass. And if they don't add it, the standard becomes increasingly disconnected from the conditions where billions of people actually live.
The deeper question about provenance versus readability. If the point of archival is shifting from preserving information to preserving evidence, then the testing standards need to shift too. Light fastness and pH are necessary, but maybe not sufficient. We might need to start testing for chemical fingerprint stability. Does the ink remain identifiable as itself after 50 years of environmental exposure?
That's a harder standard, but it's also a more honest one.
And it's where I think the field is headed, even if nobody's quite ready to write the standard yet.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for the fact that apparently Jesuits were doing cosmic ray chemistry in the 1720s. We're at myweirdprompts.com and on Spotify and Telegram. If you learned something about the marker in your hand, leave us a review. It helps other people find the show. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Go check your markers.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.